Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Good evening, everyone. Please file in behind me as I lead you to the reading room. Don't wander off. No, we don't know what that red glow in the corridor is. We're having it looked into. Maybe a swamp gas. No, Ms. Merrick is already inside. Instead of in the hallway. See? There she is in one piece.
Good evening, my dear guests. Please make yourself comfortable here in the reading room. Welcome to the Midnight Library. I am your hallowed host, Miranda Merrick. If you are as perceptive as I suspect that you are, you've no doubt already detected somewhat of a different vibe for tonight's reading. And you're correct. Something different is on offer for tonight that deserves and directs more respect and decorum. And of course, there's a very good reason for this, which I'll present for you in more detail as we go along together. Now, please know that I appreciate your visit so much that I couldn't let you be a guest without a bit of comfort of some kind, especially given tonight's topic. So I've asked our Natasha to prepare and set the hospitality tray with morning foods. Your selections on the tray include both black tea and mint tea. For any upset tummies, there are sectioned finger sandwiches, which is just a cute descriptor for the petite shape of the pleasing sandwiches, for any who may find the nomenclature to be dubious. And in the same style, we have the Victorian traditional fare of ladyfinger biscuits, being a variety of small baked bereavement biscuits or cookies that are flavored with honey, ginger, molasses, or caraway. Before baking, they are stamped with the images of hearts, crosses, skulls, and the like. These little solemn treats are then stacked in groups of two or three. Wrapped in fine paper printed with coffins, hourglasses, or perhaps skulls and crossbones, and then tied up with black ribbon and sealed with black sealing wax. All of this caring effort was done as a gentle reminder to the mourners to think of their own mortality as they consumed the somber food, and to be mindful of how death eventually consumes the living. I will tell you, my lovelies, we have more than just a few tomes here on every aspect of death, mourning, grief, death culture, and funerary and burial history and customs. And whilst gleaning these books for the procuring of the material for tonight's reading, I made a mistake in my initial approach to the subject of shrunken heads and the Victorian obsession with them. I promise you, I'm not attempting to make an excuse for my start. But I do wonder if it's because of my ancestral lineage or my upbringing that I made this mistake. But I want to be honest with you and to say that initially I was nonchalant about the subject matter, perhaps even lighthearted or even flippant. After all, we here in the library, and I venture to guess many of you, are known for your grim curiosity, acceptance of the macabre, and I imagine your love for dark and sometimes terrible things. That's what makes us us, after all, right? Well, I only needed to educate myself with the intake of some of the history of this cruel curiosity to be smartened up and set straight quite quickly. To understand that this subject, although terribly interesting, this subject and the people whom it is about deserve dignity and our respect. Let us begin. You know, whether we think of it often or not, each of us is a product of our environment and the period of time in which we are alive. If you were born in prehistoric times, you would think, believe, and behave in prehistoric ways. If you grew up in the 60s, I've read that, well, only you know what truly happened, if you can recall. But your style of existence at that time would be reflective of that time. Now, if you'll consider for just a moment that each unique culture that has sprung forth on the various continents on the face of the earth has had to undergo its own growth or evolution of all of their social constructs in their own time. From social norms, coming of age rights, language, education, religious beliefs, music, and government and laws, right down to the different types of clothing or hairstyles. All cultures move through their cultural customs at their own rate. That's why it's sometimes difficult, but ultimately best, to just take in the facts about people in the past and not to tax yourself by judging them too harshly, or as I have learned, not to force today's norms or reasoning onto the way things were in the past. I now try to not hold the past to today's standards. I find that the temptation to do this only leads to frustration and impedes my education on these historical times. No matter how odd they seem to me now. This leads me to the two groups of distinctly different people I want to tell you about tonight. They both lived in the mid-1800s and met up in the strangest, dangerous, and morbid culture clash. The Victorian people of England and European culture and the exotic tribesmen of Ecuador in the Amazonian rainforest. Each of these peoples were firmly lodged in a different mindset and understanding about death and the dead at the very same time. When they met, their differing passions about death and the dead poured fuel on a fire that neither had the vision to see the dire danger of. Without judging either of them, let me tell you their fascinating but tragic story. Briefly, beginning early in the 16th century or 1500s, Spain was endeavoring to explore, invade, and to conquer new territories, because that's what people did back then. They wanted their culture to grow and others to submit to them. It's a selfish human trait, and back then, people just didn't value other cultures or their land. They only cared about what they could do or get from other people and their land for their own people. Much of history looks just like this. The Spanish sailed to and invaded parts of South America, primarily in the Amazonian rainforest and Ecuador. They attacked and overtook or captured or forced out many indigenous tribes of native people in order to strip the land of resources like minerals and mature trees and new plants and foods to take back to their homeland to benefit their people. But there was one group of tribespeople that the Spanish never managed to conquer. These were the Shuar people of Ecuador. They valiantly fought off the advances of the Spanish conquistadors for centuries. The Shuar were fierce warriors who had untold centuries of history and knowledge about their tropical, densely forested homeland, which was a confusing, tangled alien landscape to the would-be invaders. The Shuar also displayed what most would consider to be shocking behavior. But this behavior was sacred to their belief system about death and the human soul. And what was unique about their specific tribe, the Shuar, made shrunken human heads. One reason the Shuar had endured for so long in the region was because of their powerful warring skills. They fought or hunted down anyone who threatened their village, their families, or their way of life, and they were more than just a little proficient at doing so. Hunting from the thick vegetation or hidden in the trees, they could easily bring down large animals or people with sharp spears and poisonous blow darts. And their enemies or attackers were especially valuable to them. It wasn't enough to just kill their enemy. The Shuar warriors sought to kill them and then to take something from them. That was ultimately the key to their success and their ability to keep their village safe. The Shuar killed their adversary, then cut off their head and shrunk it down to about one-fifth of its original size. Something that most people do not know, this wasn't done as revenge or punishment as we might think of it. It wasn't done to show off, and it wasn't done to collect a conflict trophy, as many might assume, especially Westerners. The Shuar did this for another reason entirely. This ancient culture believed that a person's soul and power resided in their head, and that if they removed their head, they were no longer a threat, number one, but upon shrinking and keeping the head, they would accomplish two other monumentally important things. They would shrink the head, plug the ears and nostrils with wax or clay, and then strategically sew the crucial openings of the eyes and the mouth tightly shut, thereby trapping the enemy's soul inside of his head. Then the warrior would keep this shrunken head of his enemy tied to his own body for a year or maybe even two to absorb the dead man's power, adding it to his own, so he could then protect his family and tribe with even more might. We cannot say it didn't work. In the mid-1800s, Victorian society was existing at a time that was surrounded by an atmosphere infused with death. With little understanding of medicine, health, and anatomy, mortality rates were unbelievably high. Death was so common among each strata of society that death was a way of life. Beheadings were a routine happening in town squares for these people. Just as a community art sale or a holiday gathering with a live band, music, or fireworks might be held for us today. Just as you may come away from the gathering with a keychain, an art print, or a t-shirt to commemorate the happening, the Victorians collected and displayed their loved ones' pictures taken after death and were known to keep bits of their bodies and hair and to purchase toy replicas or earrings in the shape of tiny guillotines or even locks of hair from those who had undergone the procedure. This had been happening for hundreds of years and wasn't shocking or considered to be in poor taste at this time. As many of you who have visited for our past readings on the Foxy Fox Sisters or beheadings know, it was coincidentally about this time that Victorian people were also becoming more and more interested in spiritualism, death and dead bodies in general, and what happens to the soul after the death of the body. A subject that even today is still of interest and in contention for many of us. without any solid proof yet of what happens to us after death, and only our individual experiences to go by. We, those of us here in the library, and you, our divine guests, well, we meet up at this gloomy crossroad, over and over again, don't we, my lovelies? In any case, the Victorian people at the time were influenced undoubtedly by their queen, for whom the era is named, Queen Victoria, who, after the death of her beloved husband Albert, went into mourning, deep, inconsolable mourning. Queen Victoria spent the predominant part of her long reign as sovereign in mourning. She wore only black and kept every single item in their home in the exact same place that it was the day that her husband died, in effect, stopping time. If the royal family were to sit for a photographic portrait to be taken, the queen showed up in all black, wearing a scowl, and made certain that a painting and or bust of Albert was included clearly in the photo. The queen did this not just for 40 days or a number of months or a year. She did this for 40 years. She was a model for society. So, yes, this society was affected by her and was way into death. And perhaps you can already hear the faint future echoes of what could possibly happen when the two diverse groups of people, the Victorians and the Shuar, met. During the 1840s and 50s in Ecuador, aside from everyone knowing not to mess with the indigenous people known as the Shuar, English and European explorers, venture capitalists, and workmen such as miners, gamesmen, and even botanists and early anthropologists sailed to the South American region of Ecuador. There, they continued to seek more rare minerals, plants, and trees, especially the huge rubber trees that were much in demand. And they encountered the Shuar tribe. As the Western explorers and capitalists infiltrated Ecuador and became workers and merchants in society, they witnessed the Shuar tribesmen discarding their handmade shrunken heads. The native warriors, after keeping their enemy's tiny head in contact with their own body for a year or two, believed or felt that they had finally absorbed the dead man's power, so they had no further use for the head and would simply toss it away with its soul trapped inside. And as you might have guessed, many of the Victorian tradesmen and workers picked them up and took them home to England, where the death-obsessed society, with an already deeply ingrained morbid curiosity and compulsion of collecting and displaying all sorts of dead animals and keepsakes from dead people, well, they were instantly fascinated with and irresistibly drawn to the overwhelmingly mysterious shrunken heads. The bizarre, soot-colored, minuscule heads became the talk of the nation, which spread to Europe and even North America. Everyone and their brother could not wait to feast their own eyes on a genuine, shrunken human head. First, there were only a few about, in glass cases in parlors or high up on a shelf at a pub or hotel. They were written about in newspapers, telling folks where they might travel to see one, and in which town they might find one. Demand grew, so the travelers to the far-off continent brought more of the shrunken heads back home with them. Soon, more than just the countless grim collectors wanted them. Doctors, anthropologists, scientists, businesses, and circuses were all offering money to the traveling traders and workmen to acquire the heads for them. It didn't take long for the demand to outgrow the supply. The English, European, and even Americans began offering the shuar all kinds of valuables and money, which they could use to spend in the newly forming, more modern populated areas. Money in exchange for the rarefied heads of the dead. And this caused the mindset of both cultures to warp. The Victorians and others predominantly saw the heads as thrilling or even jolting items of shock and curiosity, a thing to be stared at and pondered, stories to be told about. Even those with more professional intentions viewed them as such. There was even a kind of sly black market for the tiny heads that were taken back to England. With whispered rumors about the possibility of a shrunken head maybe being available for purchase, those in the market would be ushered into back rooms by shifty dealers, and the coveted rare item, all swaddled in a cloth, would be lifted from a grungy trunk and gingerly unwrapped before their hungry eyes. The Westerners were beyond desperate to get their hands on the miniaturized heads, with the idea of getting them into their private collections. In a dire attempt to secure the heads, they drastically increased the amount of money they were willing to pay for them. While back in Ecuador, the genuine war-begotten heads had become, to turn a phrase, thin on the ground, as they say. And this, my lovelies, is where our story officially takes an ugly turn. The Westerners were now not only offering more goods and money to the shuar for the extraordinary heads, they also began offering them a powerful tool to make acquiring new heads much easier. They offered the shuar guns. So soon, any excuse to kill a neighboring tribesman was a good enough reason to do so. Just to take his head with the aim of shrinking it and selling it directly to their covetous customers. Gone was the traditional sacred meaning of taking the heads for powerful spiritual purposes. The ancient true way of the Shuar was abandoned, and in its place was randomized murder. This is where the famed name Headhunter was born. During this dire time, many atrocities took place. Not only were the initial hallowed heads now essentially the odd playthings of the Victorians and others, the entire area from which the heads had originated became unbelievably dangerous and unstable. Here, the buyers of the heads grew more impatient as they couldn't get them fast enough. So they began making counterfeit or fake shrunken heads out of monkeys and reshaped leather. Unbelievably, the Shuar are thought to have made fakes too. But worst of all, in addition to murdering others to acquire new heads for the market, they began grave robbing and stealing the heads from the dead to shrink. I'm sorry to say, there's even proof of this appalling act happening to deceased children. Let's momentarily address what everyone is most curious about when thinking of, or perhaps viewing, a shrunken head. After all, it's a deeply inherent aspect of human nature to be instantly interested and compelled and confounded by what most would consider to be a barbaric thing to do. First, you are struck by the unbelievable sight of the thing. And you may think, why? Why would someone do this? And then your mind immediately asks, how? Basically, after decapitation, an incision is made at the back of the neck and the head, allowing the entire skin of the head to be removed. The skull is not shrunk, contrary to popular belief. And I have read one account that claims the skulls were offered to anaconda snakes of the area. The removed skin is then treated to shrink it by first boiling it, then filling it with hot sand or salts as a way of curing it. The skin is then ironed with hot rocks to seal and shape it on the outside. Then some of the shrunken heads openings are plugged and sealed and sewn shut. Some have been adorned with feathers, beads, or leather strips. The question, sadly, that most people and myself forgot to ask when viewing the small heads was, who? This has been the tragically overlooked part of the story of these beings since the beginning. Each of the human heads, since the beginning of their discovery by the visitors to the South American continent, was forgotten to be thought of as what they were and who they were, a former living human being. Someone's son, someone's father or brother. Forgetting this is where we lose our humanity No matter who they were or what they believed, they were a living person born into this world with hopes and fears like every other person. If I were to ask you, for how long did this extreme barter system of shrunken heads in trade for guns, goods, and money go on? What do you think? 10 years? 20? Or 50 years? The heinous trade before it was outlawed in 1960 continued for more than 100 years. The credit for slowly turning everyone's hearts and minds involved in the trade agreement goes to organized religion. Christian churches became established in the area and invited everyone in to discuss the fact that this act was a pointless cruelty that should come to a stop. Suddenly, I hear you wondering, has Ms. Merrick ever seen a real shrunken head? Well, I will tell you, my lovelies. I did see what I believed to be an actual shrunken head in a museum setting. I can also tell you that many of these, and there are thousands of them all over the world, in museums and private collections, many of these have been found to be clever fakes, being made of animal hide that was molded and shaped to resemble a human face. Another thing I can tell you is that I know that we make a lot of morbid, dark, and silly jokes here in the library, since we're all lovers of the macabre, and we try to warm to the darkness. And I have loved telling you the woeful story of these grievous and once sacred creations. But more importantly, I have learned to respect them as I would any deceased being, for real. You would probably want to know that there is a growing movement around the world of museums quietly removing and caringly packing away their displays of shrunken heads from the bygone era, giving them more respect and stopping them being presented to the public as what they once were, a shocking spectacle. The heads are more commonly being viewed by scientists and anthropologists who've been testing their DNA and trying to understand even more about their cultural impact. I thank you so much for learning about them with me. I'll also thank you to follow Mr. Darling, because I have other things to accomplish yet this evening. Things that don't concern you. Yet. Excuse me. Good night, my lovely dear guests. Good night.
Do you know, madam, I genuinely felt the guests didn't believe me when I said you were already inside the reading room. In one piece.
Is that how you said it? In one piece? Then yes, they're very perceptive like that.
I do think it was wise of you to take tonight's topic of shrunken head seriously, by the way.
Right, darling? We don't need to show our true nature all the time. Oh, I also took extensive notes on the shrinking process, but I can't find the book.
Oh, I have it. For calming bedtime reading.
Of course. And now we have a surprise for you. We in the Midnight Library are thrilled to introduce just what you've been waiting to get your boogery fingers on. Books from the Midnight Library shelves. But books with a single catch. You must write them. We're pleased to be releasing the first set of Midnight Library blank books. They are journals, a dream book, a planner, an address book, and a recipe book. Now available on Amazon. The titles are Dreams in the Witch House, a dream journal, The League of Lady Gravediggers, where the bodies are buried, for, record keeping, Spells to Correct Annoying People, that one's self-explanatory, Ghoul Fiends, a planner and address book, The Witch's List. Well, I'm sure the beep explains this one. And Grim Recipes for Ghoulish Gatherings, a recipe book from Grimm's Grocers. All of our fine blank books have pages in the layout directed by their titles, with ruled lines for journaling and planning and recipes, or for keeping addresses, or more importantly, secrets. Find them on Amazon under their titles or by the name of the collection, Forbidden Books from the Midnight Library. The Midnight Library is written and produced by me, Miranda Merrick. Our excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. We would like to thank everyone at our parent company, Astonishing Legends. The Midnight Library is being crowdfunded by our awesome patrons. They get everything first, plus lots of haunted extras. If you would miss the library if it closed, please support it. Visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. Do this at midnight for extra protection. To find your favorite Midnight Library, Broom and Fang Pub, or League of Lady Gravediggers bizarre merch, visit redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary, and everything will be just fine.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.